3 years in a row now, our daughter, Rebecca, has planned a surprise party for Jane. You can probably imagine what happens when you do the same thing 3 years in a row, right? Starts to lose its surprise. But she loves to plan surprise parties. She's just terrible at it. Right? Because when you do it every year, you sort of water down the element of surprise. That's just sort of natural. But then she just has a bit too much of her father in her, who just can't really contain excitement. And so she talks about the party she's planning all the time. And even while Jane is in the room, she's talking about it under not whispered, hushed tones, right? So that by the time Jane's surprise party came around this year for the 30 in a row, there was not much of a surprise. And Jane this year actually talked to her and said, hey, if you really, right, they had this talk about what surprises really require. We had a great time at her party, but surprise was just not really part of it. Compare this to the story that we just read. This group of women who had been with Jesus until the very end. They get up early on Sunday morning. Now the Sabbath was over, and so they have come to the tomb to do what you do with a dead body. They have come to prepare Jesus' corpse for burial. They have spices with them to use to help anoint and prepare him. They have come to this tomb ready to face the harsh reality of the horrific events that they saw 2 days earlier. But immediately, they come into the area where this tomb was, and they find that the stone is rolled away. Surprise, right? And then they find that the body of Jesus, the one that they saw laid there, is missing. Surprise. And then there are these two men described in dazzling clothes. Later, we'll find out that these are apparently angels. Surprise times two. And then there's the big surprise, and we get it in verse 5. Why do you seek the living among the dead, the two say? He is not here, but has risen. All right, talk about a surprise. These women have come to this tomb on this early morning full of sorrow, expecting to continue to grieve as they prepare for their friend's burial. But instead, they are told that this one that they're mourning is alive. It's unbelievable. But there's one final sort of awesome surprise in all of this. The two men talking to the women say in verse 6, remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise. I love the next line because it's so simple and it reminds us who these women are and who they've been all along. They have been some of his most diligent students. They have been sitting at his feet, learning from him. They have been following him and supporting his ministry wherever he's gone, first from Galilee and now to Jerusalem. They were with him until the end. Even now on this early morning, they have come to serve him in his death. And where are his disciples? That is his male disciples. Luke tells us that the women remembered his words. And as they remembered his words, they become the first preachers of the resurrection. These women, preparing for the grief of death, were suddenly, overwhelmingly surprised by the joy of new life, and they return to the disciples and they come with good news that Jesus is no longer in the grave, that the angels that had met them there told them that Jesus had kept his promise, that he had raised on the third day. I love that Luke names some of these key women. We heard Whitney read those names for us earlier, Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James. And we know that there were other women as well. But to name some of these women was a pretty incredible gift that Luke gives to them. The men couldn't honor these women enough to believe their word, even though they've been with Jesus from the beginning. But Luke, through the Spirit's direction, has memorialized their names for us. But there's something striking about the disciples' response, right, to these women. We know in the ancient world that women socially were considered unreliable witnesses. But there's more here than just that. The fact is, this news that Jesus was alive, can we just call it what it is? It's hard to believe, no matter who tells you, right? Luke tells us that the disciples thought this surely was just some idle tale. They aren't even surprised by the news because it seems so impossible that they don't even consider it rational or reasonable. And it's not until Peter runs to the tomb for himself that he finds himself surprised by the possibility. At least at this point, he's surprised by the absence of Jesus, even if he can't explain where Jesus is. He sees the linen grave clothes lying there, and he wonders what could be going on. If you remember my quick opening story about Becca planning a surprise party for Jane, there's this additional detail in this resurrection story that I think reveals just how unexpected all of this was. What did the angels say to the women? They said, "Remember how Jesus told you." In the Gospel of Luke, this story that we've read and we've reread over these last few months, Jesus, it turns out, is a party planner, just like my daughter Rebecca, in the spirit of Becca. Jesus told his followers two distinct times exactly what he was going to do. I am going to die, and then I am going to be raised from the dead. He did it the first time right before he started his journey to Jerusalem in chapter 9. And then he does it again right before they arrive in Jerusalem. Jesus says, "This is going to happen." When the angels then remind the women, the women remember, "Oh yeah, he did say that. He did say these things." And so this is amazing, right? It's amazing that Jesus has given away the resurrection surprise not once, but twice. He told them exactly what was going to happen and when. And it was still so unexpected that the women and the disciples are utterly shocked. They are confused. They are overwhelmed by it all. And this morning, I want to say something about why. Why this was all so unexpected. Because I think it will give us a bit of a clue as to what this is all about and what it might mean for us. So it's important to recognize that among the Jews of Jesus' day, there was a widely held belief. It wasn't held by everybody, but it was pretty wide in its sort of scope, in a future event called the resurrection. The idea was pretty simple. The Jewish people, for the most part, didn't believe that you go to heaven when you die. They believed you died and went into the grave, and there you waited until the end of this age. At the end of this age, God would raise all of the dead. He would restore humanity along with the heavens and the earth, and God's kingdom of peace would reign throughout all of creation. This resurrection would have a permanent quality to it. It wasn't like raising someone from the dead only to die again, like Lazarus or some of the others who are raised temporarily. This is what the Jews of Jesus' day called eternal life. When you were resurrected with all of creation forever. The end is the important bit here. The First Testament prophets spoke about these days. They called them the end of this age, or literally the last things, right? When the last things happen. In English, we often just talk about this as the end times. And for the Jewish mind, the last things would involve things like the judgment of the wicked, rewards for the righteous, but the climax of it all would be the new heavens and the new earth, right? That God would once again create or recreate all that he had begun in Genesis so that the final and perfect resurrection of God's good creation would last forever, and that would be humans and all of it. And all of this in their mind would take place, again, at the end, right? When everything's over. And what this means is that no one, not one person, as far as we can tell, we have no record whatsoever that anybody ever thought that God would resurrect eternally before the end, like right in the middle of history, one person. Because this just wasn't how things worked in their view of the world. This wasn't how things were supposed to work. When Jesus told the disciples not once, but twice that this is what God was going to do for him, like they couldn't even process it. Like it went in and out. They had no ability to anticipate the surprise, so that after being told twice that this was going to happen, they're like, how did this happen? They were like old wineskins, incapable of holding this new wine of what God was doing. But now it has happened. And now the women remember. Oh yeah, he said that this was going to happen. And so the question then becomes, so what does it all mean then? Right? Why would God raise someone, and Jesus specifically, now, right here in the middle of history? Well, if the resurrection was supposed to be about God making the new heavens and the new earth, then on this morning, with the resurrection of Jesus, God is announcing, behold, I am making all things new. Not just I will make all things new, but I have begun now. Look at Jesus. This is what new creation looks like. The resurrection of Jesus shows us that God has already started this project of new creation, so that Jesus, in his resurrection body, which we'll read a little bit about in a few minutes, it becomes the first sign of the new creation. So that God isn't waiting until the end of this age. He has already begun a new age right now. I hope you can sort of get a sense of like why this was so shocking to everyone, even his closest followers. Right? Because in a sense, we really like neat systems. Like first this happens, and then this happens. Right? It makes a lot of sense. But God like breaks in and goes, nah, like while this is happening, I'm going to do this at the same time. And so that if the new creation was to be a kingdom of peace ruled over by God himself, where the powerful were brought low and the meek were exalted, right? Remember some of Jesus' teachings about what this kingdom looks like. We shouldn't be surprised when this new order, this new kingdom begins to break into the world in powerful ways, in ways where women who had been completely untrusted as witnesses in the ancient world are the ones who are entrusted with this news that the new world has begun. Women who were created by God so that when you read Genesis 1 and 2, you discover they are created as co-equals with men, bearing the image of God in the beginning, that they have spent most of human history being denied their creation calling, their creation equality. In the prophet's vision for the new heavens and the new earth, women would have their creation calling restored. So you might imagine, right? If the resurrection of Jesus announces that the new creation has begun, then it makes sense that women are being invited to live in this new reality. On the other hand, men. You don't have to read much of history to know what men are capable of. Right? But have spent most of human history using their strength to dominate or subjugate really anyone weaker, but women often. Men, like the disciples, who have spent their entire time with Jesus doing pretty much one thing, which is arguing about who is the greatest among him, right? They are now being humbled. They, who have had intimate, firsthand access to pretty much every cool event in Jesus' ministry, are now the ones who are hearing about it secondhand from someone else. So that when they do finally hear about it, they don't even believe, at least not at first. The ones who should be the most ready for this moment aren't even surprised because they don't even think it's a possibility. But it turns out to be more than a possibility. On this day, a new world began. The future has entered into the present, has broken into this world. Women have already believed and are already beginning to participate in it. The eternal life that Israel longed for isn't something that comes when we die. It is the kingdom of God present that we enter into today. God has raised Jesus from the dead, and so forever has already started. Let's continue to worship this morning. I'm going to ask our team to come. Jesus, would you help us open our lives to the possibility of this new world, of this new creation, of your new kingdom in our midst today. Would you help us trust? Would you help us respond? We invite you to open our hearts and our minds to what you might be doing right now. So in our first few moments reflecting on these passages and these events, I talked about the surprise of the resurrection. Nobody expected one person to be resurrected in the middle of human history. But here Jesus is. He is the announcement that the new creation has begun. The dead, all of the dead from the beginning of time, will still be raised in the future. But that future is now underway. And as we already saw and already thought a bit about this, it's already shaping social dynamics of the world, specifically among God's people. We see this in the way that the men and women who follow Jesus begin to live with one another. But there's also another important reason why everyone was surprised by the resurrection morning's events. Earlier, I mentioned that Israel viewed time in a fairly straightforward way, right? Basically, this simple. We are living in what's called this present evil age, and at some point in the future, this age would end and the new age would begin. The old age would be gone, and this new age is all that would exist. And the resurrection of Jesus announces that the future has now begun. But all the disciples had to do was look around, and we know this feeling, don't we? Where you know the truth. The old age isn't quite gone yet. And in fact, sometimes doesn't it appear to be as strong as ever? And so the question exists for these followers of Jesus. If the old age hasn't come to an end yet, what do we do with it? What do we do here? And I think this is actually really important for us today, because in so many ways, this dynamic between all the old and the future, it explains some of the just historic struggles that people have had trying to explain evil, right? I mean, because how can we say, how can Christians dare expect to be able to say that the resurrection changes everything, right? I mean, Christians for 2,000 years have been declaring that this day, everything changed. How can we declare the beauty of God's creation, his new creation, as we look at the ugly realities around us, including, right, we prayed last week in light of our Christian brothers and sisters who were murdered for their faith in Egypt. How can we say new creation and look at this old age and see it seem to still have great power? How can we say God has defeated death, that death has no sting anymore, while people we love die? This is the great tension that God's people have tried to make sense of for 2,000 years and longer. And let me make an analogy. When we view time as simple, first this age and then the next, it's sort of like when you trade in a car and buy a new one, right? The old is gone, like literally. Don't know what happened to it. Maybe it's destroyed. Somebody else has it. The thing that matters is you don't have access to it anymore. You don't drive it. It's not yours. It's gone. And the new car is now your only new reality for driving. It is what you drive. It has taken the place of the old one, right? These are very neat and tidy categories. But the world doesn't work this way. The world or ages are less like trading an old car in for a new one, and they're more like transitioning from one computer to another. Right, the few times in my life I've needed to buy a new computer, there is always an overlap in my usage. There's data and there's content that I need to carry over from my old computer to the new computer. And while I'm starting to do all of my work on the new computer, there are still some things I need to do on the old one. The old one still demands my attention. I can't just ignore it. And so I currently have two computers, both old and new. Not right now, just saying if when you're transitioning, right? You know this experience. But the old computer isn't dead, even if it's actively dying on you. But the moment I purchased the new computer, the old computer's days were numbered, right? Kind of reminds you of like Toy Story, when the toys know the new toys that come at each birthday and Christmas means somebody's got to go. When Jesus died on the cross, he purchased for us our new lives. He bought our freedom for us. But not just for us. Jesus conquered the forces of evil that have enslaved God's creation. Freedom was purchased on the cross, not just for us, but for all of God's creation. And yet, there's something really awkward about that very first Good Friday when Jesus gave himself on that cross and he did this for us. If you think about it, Jesus had just died for the sins of the world. He just died to conquer death and defeat sin for us forever. He died to free creation from the dark and powerful forces of evil. Jesus died a glorious death. And do you know what people thought of it? Nothing. Just sadness. Like they literally had no idea what Jesus had just done. Have you ever done this? Where you do something for someone and they never know about it. And I don't mean they don't know that you did it. I mean, they don't even realize it happened at all, right? Like for some reason, maybe they're just oblivious. Maybe they just didn't notice. They don't understand or see this thing that's been done for them, but something has been done, but they have no idea. This is the story of the first Good Friday. Like we gathered here together on Friday night to retell the story of Jesus' death, and we sang together and we prayed together and we reflected on the meaning of the cross. It was powerful. I got a text later that evening that said, service tonight was really good. I was moved to tears and I still have a heavy heart. Very powerful to say these words, crucify him. And then to feel the sorrow of those who loved him. Looking forward to Sunday. That's a unique perspective that we get to have, that the people who went through that first Good Friday didn't have. What an awesome text and reflection on what we did. But we all have to sort of realize that as we walk through Good Friday together year after year, our celebrations of it just wouldn't make a lot of sense to those who were going through it the very first time there on that first Good Friday, because there was nobody looking forward to Sunday. We look forward to Sunday because we know the end of the story. But they weren't looking forward to Sunday. The women who were coming to the tomb, they weren't looking forward to Sunday. And so while we sang songs about God's love and while we prayed for God's forgiveness and we reflected on the meaning of the cross, the friends and the followers of Jesus, they just grieved, and they just grieved hard, because to them, the cross had absolutely no meaning at all except for the one meaning that the cross ever only had in the ancient world, and that is shame, and that is humiliation, and that is failure. That is the only conclusion anyone could have come to. There were only two kinds of people who ever ended up on a cross: criminals and failed revolutionaries. Jesus' followers were pretty sure he wasn't a criminal. Until Sunday morning, the people have nothing. They have nothing to suggest to them that Friday night was good. And so the resurrection becomes a double promise. It's a promise, as we've already thought about, that looks forward. Or I should say, it's a promise that takes the future and makes it a present reality. But it's also a promise that looks back. The resurrection is the first sign that God did something on the cross that was totally unexpected, completely world-changing, that could possibly turn an image of such shame into an image of glory. The resurrection is a sign that the future age has begun, but the resurrection is also a sign that this present age, the age that we know oh so well, is coming to an end. This is good news. Because what this means in some ways is actually like really practical for us. Because it means that we are going to continue to see signs of this present evil age around us because it still exists, even if it's coming to an end. And so those signs that we will see are this age clinging to its last breaths. And so we will continue to see hate and destruction and prejudice and oppression and war and famine. These are the best efforts of this present evil age to sort of flail on its way down. And so we shouldn't be surprised when we see great evil in our world. But at the same time, the birth of the new creation, the arrival of this new age means that we will see people walk in the way of Jesus. That Jesus, people saw Jesus and were completely floored by who he was and the way that he lived, that we will continue to see people who live in the way of Jesus. And so we will see incredible beauty in the midst of pain and sorrow. We will see God take the ugliness of sin and death and somehow bring beauty and life from it. We will see people lay down their lives for their enemies. We will see people laying down their idols. We will see people loving their neighbors, blessing those who persecute them, forgiving those who have hurt them, making peace everywhere. We will see these things because the new age has begun, because the new creation is bursting into creation and has been since that incredible resurrection morning. God's resurrection of Jesus proclaims, it announces a great and important truth. Sin and death reigned over God's creation, but sin and death have now been overcome. We read a few minutes ago, we heard David and Alex read for us. Jesus joins two disciples walking to Emmaus. And in verse 25, we hear Jesus say this, "Oh, foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?" And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, Jesus began to interpret to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. We're told that Jesus tells these disciples that all of this happened according to the scriptures. It's pretty incredible, right? I mean, Jesus told his disciples two different times, "I'm going to die and be raised." And they were like, "Whoa, I can't believe this happened." And now he's telling the disciples, this was supposed to happen. This is according to the scriptures. And once again, you can see, how did we miss this? But as Luke has told the story, as we hear from each of the other gospel writers, this means a couple different things. And I want to say this as we prepare this morning to come to the table together. I think it's important to consider briefly how all that happened this weekend was according to the scriptures. The Hebrew scriptures, our first testament, everything in those stories points to two events in Israel's history. They either point forward or backward to these two events, the Passover and exile. Passover and exile were the two defining events in Israel's life and their story. And part of what Jesus is saying is these two events have always pointed toward me and what I was going to do for you. And so what Jesus is saying as he walks with his confused friends is that God has now performed a new Passover. not just for Israel, but for the entire world. So that like Israel, suffering as slaves in Egypt, oppressed by Pharaoh, the whole world has suffered as slaves to far worse masters, sin and death. They have reigned. But now, through Jesus and what Jesus has done on the cross, God has set the world free from its bondage to sin and death. And so just as the Passover event reminded God's people that they had been set free from their bondage in Egypt, so too now the whole world has been invited to join God in being set free from our bondage to sin and death. This is great news. But he's also saying one more really important thing. When Israel went into exile, when Israel lost everything they had and were sent off to a foreign nation, God told Israel that there was a reason for their exile. And that reason was their sin. They had turned from God and rejected him. And so God gave them over to the powers of this world. God let the powers of this world exile them. And there they have lived for hundreds of years. Hundreds of years have passed, and their exile has not yet been completed. One of the messages that the prophets kept speaking to Israel was this, that there is only one thing that could bring their exile to an end. Israel needed to be forgiven of her sins. If sins are what took her into exile, she needed to be forgiven. She needed to be set free both from the consequences of her sins and also from the power of sin. And so as Jesus walks with these disciples, he likely makes this his second point. The whole earth has been in exile through sin and disobedience from the beginning. But now the death of Jesus is sufficient proof that God is offering forgiveness, not just to Israel, but to, hey, the whole world, everybody. Forgiveness has been granted. Sinners are forgiven. All of them, everywhere. And this means God's people are free to come out of exile, and they are free to come out of this dying evil age, and they are free to now walk in the newness of life in the age to come. That's not just to come, but that is now, because Jesus is the beginning of the new creation. Jesus is inviting his people to come home to their loving Father. Exile isn't just about leaving a dying world. It's about entering a world of love where the Father has been calling and has been eager to embrace his lost children. And so the resurrection declares, the resurrection announces, you have been forgiven. You have been forgiven. You have been set free. So come and join God's new and beautiful kingdom. Join with him. Know him. Walk with him. Enjoy the beauty of this new creation that's found near to him. The reason that I guess that these are the things that Jesus said to his disciples is because, as we'll read in our final resurrection passage this morning in a few minutes, when they are sent out to preach the good news, they start with this. They preach this very message. You have been forgiven. Repent, turn, join, enter God's kingdom. And they will start in Jerusalem and they will go to the nations. This has been the story of God's scriptures from the beginning, and here, now, they get to carry it out. And so we remember together this morning that we come to this table of victory. This is the feast of victory for our God. And so you are invited to repent of your love for the old age and to trust Jesus as the King of the new age.